Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word.
The Epistle of Paul to the Romans, chapter 1, verse 16. In our overview survey of Romans, we've already seen that Paul repeatedly mentions two covenant peoples, Israel of the law and the body of grace. The covenant of law, that's from Abraham's circumcision through Christ. And that was the first of the two to govern the life of a covenant people. First, it was the law and the covenant of grace from Paul right up and through you, if you're a believer, is the second of those two groups to govern the life of a covenant people. Both covenants reside in the overarching gospel of Christ. They're both a part of what Jesus Christ is doing to save people in the world, even though they're two different covenants provided for by him and by his blood. Both covenants provide salvation and required faith. Both of them, the first covenant did when it was in effect, as ours does today. But first, God gave the covenant of law to Israel, and secondly, he gave grace to the Gentiles. Thus, Romans 1:16, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first, and also for the Greek. For in it," that is, in the gospel of Christ, "the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith." So when Paul says to the Jew first and also for the Gentile, that's what that Greek means here, to the Jew first, I don't think that means that in the gospel of grace, the Jew comes first. He gets to get saved first, that Christ's blood is for him first in the body of Christ, and I don't think it's an historical reference to Paul's habit of going to the Jews first. I think he's making a doctrinal statement that the gospel went to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles. Now, when he says from faith to faith in verse 17, what does that mean? From faith to faith, from sea to shining sea. What does that mean, from faith to faith? It means that God revealed his righteousness from one faith to another, from one covenant to another, from one dispensation of law to another of grace. Now, Paul expounds on this in Romans 4 and 10, as we've already seen, but in chapter 10, he really clarifies this point, that God's righteousness is available in one way or another, in one covenant or another. Romans 10:5 says Moses writes about the righteousness which is of the law, and in 10:6, but the righteousness of faith speaks in this way, in another way. So you have the righteousness of law through the faith of Israel, and the righteousness of grace, which is through the faith of the body of Christ. There's one God, the giver of two faiths, one of the covenant of law for Israel, and the other of the covenant of grace for the body, revealed from faith to faith, for the Jew first and also for the Gentile. For the Jew first, historically, because circumcision governed the life of a covenant people first for 19 centuries. It was the covenant of circumcision. Prior to faith alone governing the life of God's covenant people, it was circumcision. But then for the last 19 centuries, it's been the covenant of grace. So the first 19 centuries, just coincidentally, was a covenant of circumcision. And the 19 centuries since Paul was saved, it's been the covenant of grace, soon to be 20 centuries. Paul fought to keep his own converts from reverting to the older faith, to the first way. So in his letter to the Galatians, Paul called Peter a hypocrite because he was tempting Paul's converts to live by Israel's law instead of by their own grace. And so Paul begins Galatians writing, he says, "I marvel that you are turning away so soon from grace to a different gospel, which is not another." Now, what faith were the Galatians turning to? "I marvel that you're turning to a different gospel, which is not another." What does he mean by that? Well, the gospel that Paul refers to is the one that went to the Jews first, from faith to faith. They were reverting from Paul's faith by grace alone to Peter's faith plus the works of the law. That's where they were going back to. So when Paul said, "You are turning from grace to a different gospel, which is not another," he used two different Greek words, allos, which is another of the same kind, and heteros, which is another of a different kind. So you are turning from grace to a different gospel, another of the same kind, which is not another of a different kind. They're both from the same God. In other words, there were similarities between these two gospels. Peter learned of the law from Christ as Paul learned of grace from Christ. And both gospels are of Christ. Yet the one calls for obedience to the law and the other celebrates deliverance from the law. But in his writings, Paul finds ways to defend his gospel of grace by quoting the Hebrew scriptures. Even if the Hebrew scriptures are talking about law, Paul will find a way to quote and to isolate just the part about faith, just the part about grace, and he'll quote that as his proof text, as he does here at the end of verse 17 when he quotes the Hebrew prophet Habakkuk, "As it is written, the just shall live by faith." Of course, for the Jews under circumcision, they had to live by faith, but it was faith plus keeping the law. So that sentiment, "the just shall live by faith," that fit well into their covenant. But for those in the body, we must live only by faith. So you put this quote in Paul's mouth and it has a different meaning. It's no longer part of the overall covenant. It's now the entire covenant, the exclusivity of faith alone in the body. So in the first 17 verses, Paul discusses the gospel and the people of faith. Now, beginning in verse 18 to the end of the chapter, he turns his attention and his tone to address the wicked, those in opposition to God. Verse 18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." So Paul says the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against the wicked. Well, how so? How is the wrath of God revealed? We don't have plagues of locusts and darkness and lice. We don't have those. The water is not turning to blood. So how is the wrath of God revealed from heaven against the wicked? Well, just look at the misery that engulfs the world. Man's inhumanity to man would not exist if God did not leave us to our own devices. God gave the law, Paul will explain in chapter 7, to make sin exceedingly sinful. That's why God gave the law. For the greater man's wickedness, the more that individuals will turn toward God for relief. Because if the world gets especially cruel, then individuals will seek refuge in God. So in so many varied ways, God's wrath is revealed against rebellious mankind. Every hurricane that destroys a village speaks of the wrath of God. Not that God orchestrated the hurricane. But its very existence shows that God is angry at mankind. Every flood that drowns out a life is an echo of the great flood. For it could not occur if God hadn't unleashed his wrath upon the world, changing our paradise into a dangerous place. Every earthquake and every war speaks of God's protection withheld from mankind. Every crime reveals God's wrath, not in that he choreographed it, but that he does not stop it, thus revealing his wrath from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. God gives them the rope they need to hang themselves. Of course, ultimately, he will vindicate the innocent on Judgment Day, but he will utterly punish those who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, the last phrase of this verse. Suppress the truth. Think of the science teacher who withholds mountains of evidence for creation, and the historian who knows that recorded human history goes back only a few thousand years before Christ, yet it speaks of extraordinary, sophisticated culture. And the historian does nothing to point that out to his students. And think of the medical doctor who suppresses the truth when he relies upon the body's intricate and complex chemical response to his treatments. And without this perfect functioning of the body, he could never heal anyone. Yet he gives no credit to the great physician who designed us. And among those who suppress the truth are the abortionists, who know full well that the unborn child fights for life, and the homosexual activist, who knows better than anyone of the deep misery in their community. Those who suppress the truth include the theologian who rejects the inspiration of the Bible while unshakably drawn to its pages. Those who suppress the truth include the linguist who conceals the sudden appearance of complex language in man's history, and the paleontologist who downplays the sudden appearance of life in the fossil record, and the counselor who denies the importance of sexual purity, and the journalist who hides the wickedness of atheistic socialists, and the sociologist who exaggerates the failures of Christians. The wrath of God is revealed against all who suppress the truth. Verse 19, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. Now, what may be known of God is manifest. That is, it's made clear in them. And see, it doesn't only say to them, but it says in them. What may be known of God is manifest in them, in the wicked. Now, how can that be? Well, we human beings, we can study the world around us, but we can know ourselves even better than organisms outside of us. For example, we might be able to learn something about the planet Saturn, but how much more can we clearly study the Earth? And we might be able to research microorganisms, but how much more our own cells? You can study a dog, but you can study yourself. Well, what does the dog think about when he's eating? I don't know. He probably thinks about eating. What do you think about when you're eating? You could really know. So you could study yourself intimately. And just by what God has done in us, he has utterly proved his own existence. Remember when some argued that rocks on Mars formed the outline of a face? Remember the face on Mars? And there were extraterrestrial types who desperately want to believe in life from outer space. And of course, the vast majority of them are evolutionists. And these people saw this NASA photo of what looked like the outlines of a face, a very rudimentary face, not as perfect as a smiley face, but it looked sort of like a face. And now we know from additional photos taken in the same location, it was shadows by rocks on the surface of Mars, and it looked a little bit like a face, sort of like the man on the moon and the face on Mars. Well, these evolutionists argued passionately that there must be intelligent life on Mars, because such an outline of a face could never occur by mere chance. It had to be the result of intelligent design. Do you think their hypocrisy ever occurred to them? That they believe an actual human face with the blood vessels and everything working and the eyes and the organs, that that evolved by chance, but some stupid outline of a face had to be intelligent design? What a hypocrisy. What fools. Lately, I'm fond of pointing out the extraordinary, unlikely chance that eyesight could possibly begin to evolve by chance. Think about a living organism that has no eyesight, and by chance, it's going to begin to evolve sight. So first, it has to evolve a collection mechanism to receive the waves of light, the photons. So it takes the ambient light and then focuses it. And then it has to, by chance, begin to evolve a mechanism to transfer those signals, to convert them from photons into chemical or electrical signals, and then transport them to the brain. And then the brain has to, by chance, begin to evolve some way of receiving that input and then processing it. And then, by chance, it has to begin to take that information and give it to the part of the brain that's conscious. And it needs to evolve a way to merge that information of that imagery into all the other sensory input so that it makes sense and so that it's not upside down. It goes so far beyond the realm of a reasonable possibility to just an insanely absurd proposition. Yet, not only do evolutionists believe that our eyesight evolved by chance, but so too did our sense of smell and of taste and of touch and the awesomely complex sense of hearing. And they all happened by chance and all merged into individual organisms. And they're right there in your face, all five, all wildly unlikely. And for anyone to be able to look into a mirror or just to consider their own body and the fact that they exist and that they're pondering their origins, and for not to know that there is a God who created them, is an act of ultimate rebellion and a willful ignorance, refusing to admit that which has been clearly shown to them, that all these things are by chance. For what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. Not only that our physical bodies are here, but our conscience, affirming to us a standard of right and wrong, even though that internal standard often condemns us. If it's just something you made up, why wouldn't it make you look good? Why does it make you look bad, your conscience? Why do you violate your conscience? That's evidence that there's an external standard that's been imposed upon us. What may be known of God is manifest in us, for God has shown it to us. Our fear of the dead. Why are we afraid of the dead? Are other species afraid of the dead? Is a dog afraid of the dead? Not that I've experienced. I haven't owned many pets. A goldfish hardly counts. But as far as I know, the animal world, they're not afraid of dead animals. But we, with the greatest intellect, we're afraid of the dead. Why? And it's universal. It gives us a creepy feeling. Whether it's a loved one or a stranger, you come across a dead body, and even if you know there's a dead body in the closet, half the women will run on the other side of the room, and some of the guys will tiptoe over. and take a look. And Gordon has experience. He'd just take out his gun and go in there and shoot it again. No. But dead bodies freak us out, while they don't to any other species on Earth. Why? Well, we human beings are created with a knowledge of life after death. And a dead body brings us closer to that next life than anything else. There it is. That guy who was living and breathing 1 minute ago is now in the presence of God, if he's a Christian, or he's in hell. And that freaks us out. It's weird. God, what may be known of God, is manifest in them. Liberals, they deny sexual morals, yet God clothed us and they continue to wear clothes. Even if they might deny it in some extreme circumstance in their normal day-to-day life, they sure dress up. The human incessant activity of pairing off into couples through marriage, even by liberals who deny that God said, let the two become one flesh. Even if they deny everything, they still want to get married. Why? Just forget it. Just forget that marriage thing. In their rebellion, they affirm the truth of God's created order. Our persistent belief in God and the constant references to him, even by liberals who say they deny his existence. Well, why do you talk about him 30 times a day? What may be known of God is manifest in them. Verse 20, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. I love this verse. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the creation, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. People say, you can't prove God. And I disagree with that routinely. They say, well, you can't prove God. Yes, you could. No, you can't. Well, give me a minute. You have 30 seconds? Let's do it. This verse here says that God is clearly seen, so that they are without excuse. Can you prove that somebody committed a crime? Well, knuckleheads think you can't prove anything. You can't prove that they exist. So they're fools. But if you have a videotape of some guy who says, I was never even in that 7-Eleven. Then you have the videotape. You see him smiling. You see him pull the gun. You see him take the money. And you say, look, you did it. We can clearly see the evidence that you did it. Now, it's true. Some who deny everything in the validity of any knowledge will say, well, we can't know. And they're fools. How do they know they can't know? If they can't trust anything, they couldn't know that. So they contradict themselves. But if the evidence is clearly seen, then you've proved it. Can you prove OJ murdered Nicole and Ron Goldman? Well, yes. But if we had a video of him doing it that he was showing to his latest girlfriend on his own TV, look at this, I took this video. There'd still be people who would deny it. Even if he admitted it, they would deny it. So there is an aspect of human behavior, which is pride and ego, which refuses to humble itself once you've gone down a wrong path. Somebody starts out saying, OJ's innocent, then it does not matter how much evidence eventually that person sees. If they don't have humility, they'll maintain he's innocent. And so too with God. If somebody says there's no God, you begin to pile on the evidence. It doesn't matter how much. If they don't have humility, they'll never believe. Well, since the creation of the world, God's attributes have been seen. Three of them. That he is eternal, that he is omnipotent, all-powerful, and that he is personal, a Godhead. Well, how could those three things be seen? God's eternal nature, his power, and his personality, that he's a person. How could they be seen in the creation? Well, let's start with that the world is here. The world is here, and it could not make itself. So where did it come from? It couldn't have been here forever, because if so, by now, the sun would have burned out, as would have every star in the universe. And the universe itself, if it had always been here, would be a cold, dead place. So the universe could not have always been here, because it's warm, hot, burning, fires. So did it make itself? Did the universe make itself? Well, a rock cannot make itself out of nothing, and a fire cannot burn forever. The universe cannot be a perpetual motion machine, always working and moving, because science teaches us, the laws of physics tell us, that if work is being done, you're consuming energy in a way that you cannot continue eternally. Because when you do work, like if you burn a fire, you get wood, you burn a fire, you have smoke and ashes, you've transferred matter into energy and heat energy. You've done a lot of work. You heated the room. Well, once the fire is out, can you gather the smoke and the ashes and create a fire that was equally as hot and burned for an equally long time? You can't do it because of the laws of physics. You lose energy through friction and useless heat energy that just dissipates, and it would take more energy to collect it all than you could possibly recreate by starting the fire again. So you can't have a perpetual motion machine. You cannot have a fire that burns forever. These are the basic laws of physics. So the universe itself cannot be a perpetual motion machine. It cannot violate the laws of physics. Eventually, if it had always been here, it would have been burned out by now. So we only have three options. Either the universe, the physical universe, the natural world, the cosmos, either it was always here, or it brought itself into existence, or something else brought it into existence. Those are our only three options. Now, atheists don't like that there are only three. But for many years, I have offered them the opportunity to come up with another one. Surely you've read books written by intelligent atheists. What other possibilities are there? They can't come up with any. That's it. It was either always here, or it brought itself into existence, or something else brought it into existence. So if we only have three options, we could see which of them are logical, which of them are disqualified for being irrational or unscientific. Number one, the universe could not have always been here because the stars would be burned out by now. Number two, the universe could not have created itself out of nothing. That's magic, not science. You can't create yourself out of nothing. You didn't exist to do it.
Hey, this is Bob Enyar. If you would like to hear more, you could go to our store online. Go to KGOV.com, click on the store, and then you could get our Bible studies, or go to the subscriptions where you could subscribe to our sermons and our Bible studies. You could get really fun verse-by-verse studies or topical Bible studies. I think you'll love it.